Great call-in radio show number 30. We did talk about enclamiphene for testosterone optimization. We talked about habit formation and how you can keep sort of sacred spaces in order to create sort of positive conditioning and avoid sort of negative conditioning. We talked about why it's important not to mix cardio and weightlifting excessively. Preventing sort of overtraining by, you know, focusing your training and focusing more on consistency and volume. Welcome to Maximus Call-In Radio Show number 30. Can't believe we've done 30 episodes at this point, and it is July 1st, feeling like summertime. Hopefully it is wherever you are in the world. Welcome for our first-time callers. This is a call-in radio show format, so if you have any questions, you can call in live. You can join us on Discord. You can type in your questions on Instagram Live. We're also hosting on Twitter Spaces and Clubhouse, so just raise your hand and I can bring you to the top of the room and you can ask your questions live. And on YouTube Live, I believe, as well, you can type in your questions. We always try to prioritize people in our community, so feel free to do that. And we also have some questions that were submitted in advance, so happy to always answer those as well. One of the things that we do just to get things going is what we call our weekly unpopular opinion, talking about sort of the state of the world's affairs. And I posted this one actually on Twitter, and this week's unpopular opinion is that, in my opinion, one of the biggest predictors of a man's life satisfaction is whether he has other guys he can basically send controversial memes to and laugh at together. It's actually funny because there's a lot of talk in Silicon Valley about the importance of sort of psychological safety. And, you know, in the world that we live in, which is very sort of oriented around cancel culture, unfortunately, I don't think people can sort of, share things that may be sort of edgy or funny or controversial, unless it's literally a stand-up comedian, because that's one of the few sort of safe spaces that actually exists in modern society, in my opinion. And the other one is, quite frankly, the therapy room. Where obviously privacy and confidentiality is king, and you can sort of share your opinions unabashedly. So I think what's really happened as a result of this culture is, a lot of, you know, interesting opinions, takes, it all gets sort of relegated to private conversations, text messages, etc. And I think it's actually important. It's not that we necessarily should be promoting or pushing controversial opinions, but I think there is something important about being able to speak freely without the harm of sort of social repercussions or feeling like you're going to be canceled or there's going to be negative repercussions in any way. Because even if you are saying something that maybe you shouldn't be saying, you have a private opportunity for a friend who's a trusted individual to correct you and say, hey, you know, that's inappropriate, or maybe you're not thinking about this in a very robust way, or I respectfully disagree. And it gives you the chance to learn and correct and grow by having a friend, a colleague, et cetera, be able to do that. And so I actually think it's a very, very important predictor for your kind of learning and growth, but also in terms of life satisfaction, because, you know, I think humor and not taking yourself too seriously and using humor as a way of essentially diffusing from the challenges of life is really important. And whether or not you're into social media or memes per se, I do think there is something that it is to be said about sort of sharing humor, sharing joy, sharing mirth. And you need to be able to have at least one person to do that. And the reason, by the way, I brought this up is there was a fascinating poll that was done by, I believe it was the Survey Center on American Life. And what they did is they surveyed men and women over 31 years. So the original survey, I believe, was done in 1990. And they asked people a very simple question. How many close friends do you have? And it's really interesting. In 1990, men, and we're looking at the extreme end of things, right? The people who had no friends, no close friends, and people who had a lot of close friends, which is defined as 10 or more. So in 1990, 40% of men had 10 or more close friends. Now in 2021, the current year that we live in, that has declined to 15%. So we went from 40% of people who had 10 or more close friends, and now it's 15%, right? So it's a huge decline in terms of the robustness of close friends in our social network. If you look on the extreme other end of the spectrum, which is how many people have zero close friends. Now, you'd expect this to be a very small minority of people who are kind of loners, quite frankly. And that used to be true in 1990. Only 3% of men had zero friends. Guess what that percentage is now in this day and age? It's 15%, right? So in the span of 31 years, right, like basically less than one generation, we've quintupled or 5x'd the amount of men who had zero friends. So 15% is not insignificant. I think it's like 1 in 8 guys basically has zero friends. So zero friends to be able to share a joke or a meme or confide in or learn from. And I think that's an incredibly sad fact. And that rate is worse than what's happening with women. This trend, by the way, still exists for women as well. It's just less precipitous. So in 1990, 28% of women had 10 or more friends. That's declined to 11%. And only 1 or 2% of women in 1990 had zero friends. That's increased to 10%. So 50% more men in the current year have zero friends compared to women. So that's 15 versus 10%. So it seems to disproportionately affect men. It's not surprising because women are quite frankly better than men in terms of forming and maintaining close relationships, especially outside of their primary romantic relationship. I really give women credit for that in terms of, you know, tending and befriending is sort of the term that's used in psychology and having sort of resilience in terms of their social networks. But it's a really interesting question. What the hell happened in American society in the last 31 years where 10 to 15% of women and men have zero essentially close friendships? And you can imagine what obviously that does for our psychological health. Because we know that, for instance, loneliness is one of the biggest predictors of mortality or death, right? It's in fact a better predictor than many physiological markers, right? People underestimate sort of psychological markers. I think there's probably many things that's going on, but here's the interesting thing that's happened post 1990 is essentially it's the rise of the internet, right? And the internet promised us connection, social connection, right? Like the motto of Facebook is literally connect everyone and bring them together. You never forget a friend's birthday. You can reach out to anyone, keep in touch with old high school friends, etc. I think the evidence is pretty damning that that vision has essentially not come true. Now, it is true in one sense, and yes, you have the ability to, keep in touch with thousands of people. But the real question is, that does that matter in the sense that we don't need to keep in touch with thousands of people? You need close friends that, like I said, you can trust, you can laugh with, and that can provide instrumental support, meaning like, are they going to pick you up from the airport? Can they help you with a loan? Can they, be your godfather to your children? These are real sort of tangible support mechanisms. And I don't think social media has helped. In fact, I think it's harmed it. I think what's happened is that we've become essentially zombie-like consumers of media, especially social media. And it's given us the illusion of connection because we're never really alone when you're online. You're reading your friends or acquaintances or internet friends, spicy takes on Twitter, Instagram. And so it gives this illusion, just like when you're watching a reality TV show. The reason it's addictive is because we care about what's going on in your social network. You should be attuned to what's the dynamics and the drama of your tribe, because if you're not understanding like where the hierarchy is, who's in charge, what's going on, you're going to be kicked out if you're not aware. I think essentially reality TV and media has hijacked that because it makes us care about the Kardashians rather than your own actual family or relatives, which is what you actually should be caring about. But now social media has extended that because it's on all the time. Rather than an episode of the Kardashians that you may watch for an hour a week, you can literally engage for many, many hours a day. That, and gaming in particular for young men, has, I think, subverted the hero's journey, right? You should be working on leveling yourself up in life, taking on new challenges, enriching yourself, not just financially, but psychosocially and spiritually. And it's just easier to do that in the context of a game rather than in the slow slog of real life. And so I think my interpretation for why that is I think social media and gaming in particular has given us the illusion of connection, but it's actually left us, quite frankly, much more alone. So the solution, of course, in my opinion, is not to abstain altogether. We can't run away from the internet. And obviously, social media provides us benefits in terms of sharing hopefully high quality content like I'm doing right now, but it's dopamine fasting, right? It cannot be on all the time. We can't be over consumers of it. Just as food is not unhealthy, it's the excess quantity and the poor quality of food that really makes us obese and sick. It's the same thing with social media. We essentially need a social media and internet diet because I think otherwise it gives you this fake fullness, if you will, right? You walk away from it being like, oh, okay, you know, I felt like there was a lot of social interaction there, but it's not that close, meaningful connection that actually provides real satisfaction and fulfillment. And at the end of the day, you're not left with real friends, right? You're left with the illusion of a whole bunch of acquaintances. And one real friend, close friend, that's a ride or die, is worth 100 fake friends, in my opinion. And I think everyone should hopefully agree with that. I've talked about this on social media too, in terms of you only need really a handful of close friends. In fact, if you look at the median, most people really only have one or two best friends, and that's usually their primary romantic partner and or a best friend. They have 4 to 6, I believe, if I remember the numbering correctly, close friends that they contact on a weekly basis as opposed to a daily basis of their partner and their best friend. And then there's everyone else. So really, I always tell people, you only need like 4 to 7 or about a handful of close friends. And so that's really what you should be aspiring towards in life. And if you don't have that, then get offline and try to find ways of connecting with people in real life. You can use social media, WhatsApp, other channels to complement it. Like I said, you know, I have friends who live in New York. We don't necessarily see each other, obviously, because of the connection, but we use Signal, WhatsApp, whatever communication channels just to send memes. We actually provide professional advice regarding work because we're working on similar things. And so you can obviously use it for good as well. But I think the end of the day, you have to evaluate yourself by whether it's working in terms of evaluating how many close friends do I really have that would be ride or die for me? And what's the connection and quality of those relationships? Do I feel like I'm learning, growing, spending more time with them as opposed to less? So this is really an unfortunate, disturbing trend that I think we're seeing in American society, but I think it's our individual responsibility to ameliorate it. I do think there's a social responsibility as well, but I think the responsibility, at least for now, definitely falls on our own shoulders to find those close friends. So, all right, that's this week's unpopular opinion.
Good. First, congrats on launching the Maximus King. I guess my question is,
thank you.
Since I can't get it up here in Canada, is it a good idea to seek out the enclomiphene pill? And if it is a good idea, how would I go about doing that? What would I look for?
Good question. I honestly don't know what the availability of it is in Canada, because the laws in every country are quite frankly very different in terms of drug approval. Like the US uses the FDA in terms of how it approves drugs, and because enclomiphene is essentially a purified clomid, which has been FDA approved here in the United States since 1967, it's available here. I have no idea in terms of the availability in Canada. I would guess it's probably not. It's not sort of this particular form of clomid is not commonly found. So you can do your best. The other problem is even if you theoretically source it, you have to find a doctor that'll prescribe it. I don't have a lot of advice, unfortunately, on that because I'm not an expert in Canadian medicine and Canadian healthcare law. But I do hope that one day we are able to expand to Canada and provide that service. Or if you ever find yourself in the US, happy to serve you here. So for those of you who are not familiar, the gentleman who called in is talking about enclomiphene, which is one of the core constituents of our what we call our King protocol or our testosterone maximization protocol. And it's a tremendously effective medication that's relatively safe and effective for maximizing testosterone. And I'll explain to you what it is, how it works, in case you're sort of curious. So enclomiphene is essentially an isomer. So there's two different isomers of what's called clomid, the brand name, or clomiphene, which is, as I mentioned, a fertility drug. It's actually FDA approved for the treatment of fertility in women, and it's all commonly used off-label for fertility in men as well. So if you are typically having trouble conceiving with your partner, in males, it helps increase sperm count and sperm quality, motility, etc. So you can obviously help get your wife pregnant. So that's the primary use case of it in men. It's been used for a long time. The problem with that use case is they give men very high doses of Clomid, oftentimes like 25 to 50 milligrams, which makes sense for what you're trying to do. You're just trying to produce as much sperm as possible in order to, you know, obviously fertilize an egg and get your wife pregnant. The goal is not to feel good, quite frankly. It's to just get the job done, so to speak. And so typically they put these guys in these huge dosages and they don't typically feel very good. The reason for that is the two isomers have different actions. The enclomiphene isomer is an estrogen receptor antagonist, and zuclomiphene, the other isomer, is an estrogen agonist. So it almost has these like mixed effects. On the one hand, blocking the estrogen receptor tells your body, oh, I'm not getting enough estrogen. And because the body derives estrogen from testosterone, testosterone is broken down into estrogen through an enzyme called aromatase, the body is just like, oh, you're not getting enough estrogen, let me make more testosterone. So essentially you're almost tricking the body into producing more of its own natural testosterone. It stimulates the testes produce luteinizing hormone turns into testosterone turns into estrogen, or what's called estradiol. So that's essentially how it works. The problem though is that zuclomiphene isomer stimulates the estrogen receptor, it makes guys moody, messes with their libido, etc. So while it's a good short-term solution for fertility, it's not a great long-term solution for testosterone, because what ends up happening is that zuclomiphene isomer ends up building up more and more in your bloodstream. So the ratio of the two, it's 62% enclomiphene, 38% zuclomiphene. But what ends up happening over time, it becomes almost like 95-5, because one has a very short half-life. Enclomiphene's half-life is only like 10 and a half hours, meaning that if you take it, most of it is 50% or more of it is eliminated out of your bloodstream within 10 hours or so, versus zuclomiphene literally stays around for weeks. And so over time, because of the long half-life, more and more of it accumulates. And so all you're getting is the isomer that you don't want that has more of the side effects, and you're getting less and less of the isomer that you do want. So that's why Clomid, if you talk to a lot of guys who've either taken it for fertility or even maybe off-label for testosterone optimization, they usually feel great at first. Their testosterone skyrockets. And then what happens over time is that balance, right, of like 2/3, 1/3 enclomiphene to zuclomiphene starts to get more and more out of whack. And it becomes like 5/95. And all you're getting is sort of the estrogenic side effects. And then guys, their testosterone is still high, but they're feeling really estrogenic. And their balance between their testosterone and estrogen is all out of whack. And they're feeling, quite frankly, feminine because of their estrogen is totally out of control. That's why it's not really a great solution. Some guys now, interestingly, maybe just because of their individual physiology, do really fine on enclomiphene. I've talked to people who take 25 milligrams a day. They don't get any of the side effects. They're totally fine. On the other hand, there are guys who do experience the moodiness, the messing up of their libido, and sometimes people get sort of rare ocular effects. It does seem to put some strain on the retina. And so sometimes people get some very rare sort of eye conditions, or even like floaters, if you're familiar with those. And so I'm not particularly a huge fan of sort of Clomid as a standalone long-term for hormone optimization, but enclomiphene, because it's the purified isomer, like I talked about, it eliminates all of these issues. At least my reading in the research literature, there's none of the ocular side effects that happen. And at least clinically, anecdotally, you're not getting that moodiness, the messing of the libido that you do with Clomid. It's a much cleaner, essentially, version of Clomid with a lot less of those side effects. It's also more potent. That's the interesting thing, because like I said, it's 62% of Clomid. You can take a much lower dose, right? So the 6.25 milligrams that has been used in the clinical trials is actually equivalent to 10 milligrams of Clomid. Or if you double that dose, the 12.5 milligrams, it's equivalent to about 20 milligrams of Clomid. So it's much more potent, you get more bang for your buck. And like I said, it's sort of clean, it's a much cleaner, pure version. And in fact, the side effects are so low, they do exist, all drugs have side effects. In the clinical trials, they weren't any different than placebo, right? So if you're getting the same side effects as literally a sugar pill, it's pretty good in terms of side effects. And the side effects are pretty common. It's like headaches, nausea. It's all the very like mild sort of side effects. And they're not usually significant enough to turn into what are called adverse effects, meaning effects that are significant enough that required people to drop out of the clinical trial. So that's why it's much better, I think, and sort of revolutionary in terms of what it can do. And then the results are fantastic, right? So we just did an alpha pilot in California and Florida. On average, people's free testosterone, I believe, went up 1.9x, right? So if you're starting out at a free testosterone of 100, basically going up to almost 200, right? Which in a healthy young male would be 90th plus percentile, healthy young non-obese male, I should say. If you're obese, it does kind of mess with your hormones a little bit more. So the results that we're getting are really, really fantastic in terms of the testosterone optimization. And it was interesting. We just got some user feedback from people, and a lot of people were like, it's great. I don't have to inject myself with TRT. My balls aren't shrinking. I don't have to deal with infertility. In fact, as we talked about, it's a fertility drug, so it actually makes things better in that regard. And yeah, it's just a pill that I take before I go to bed, just like how women optimize their hormones with birth control. So we are getting, you know, really good effects from our pilot, and we were really excited to actually sort of soft launch publicly in California and Florida. So we emailed, I think we have 10,000 people right now on our wait list. So we emailed them all and said, hey, look, if you finally want to have this become available, it's now available to you. So if you're listening to this and you want to go check it out, we actually do have a landing page that's up. It's maximizeyourtestosterone.com. So you can check it out, maximizeyourtestosterone.com. I have a 9-minute video where I talk a little bit in depth about how the program works, about sort of the epidemic in terms of declining testosterone sperm count levels, which is a big point. Like, you don't have to have low T or low testosterone to be on this protocol. I literally use it along with a lot of people on our alpha protocol because it's beneficial. And so I, just like our clinical advisors always say, we treat symptoms, not numbers. So if you are not feeling, looking, performing your best, you're feeling tired, you don't have the drive, energy, and confidence like you used to or want to have, then it can be tremendously beneficial. We do measure your levels in order to prove that essentially it's working on a physiological level and it's not just a placebo, as we talked about. So you kind of get the best of both worlds in terms of hopefully you feel a qualitative benefit and you'll clearly see a quantitative benefit as well. So yeah, check it out, California and Florida. And we are, the other good news that I wanted to announce today is, you know, we found a new pharmacy partner that is available in all 50 states. So we're gonna slowly expand state by state, hopefully to Texas next. And we're already trying to get New York up and running. So if you are in Texas and New York, keep your eyes peeled. Hopefully in the next few weeks to months, we'll be able to launch in your neck of the woods and continue to expand and grow from there and be able to serve more and more good men like you. We had a question come in from Instagram from Carlos. He's asking, following with the unpopular idea of the week, in your experience, what kind of activities do provide the most unity feeling between friends? Is it the amount of time shared, work-related, hobbies, etc.? This is a great question. In fact, I wrote an entire paper in college about this because I thought this phenomenon was really fascinating because one of the interesting observations, and I spent years working in VA hospitals working with military veterans, and there's two interesting observations that I had. One, military veterans have a bond beyond any other, right? There's guys who like have not seen each other in 30, 40 years, but because they literally went to war together, they're like blood brothers for the rest of their lives. And that level of like connection and kinship to me is like amazing because how many, you know, relationships are able to kind of stay that close, even if you don't necessarily have the same level of contact, but you're able to almost like rekindle it or restore it. So that's one. And then second, there's almost like a shared tribal experience of being in the military. Even if you didn't necessarily, you weren't friends in the military, right? You didn't necessarily serve together, but you're part of the Marine Corps, right? And they always say that, like, there is no such thing as an ex-Marine. Once a Marine, always a Marine. And so you could have served in different countries, in different times, different stations, different responsibilities, but you're part of the same club, the same community, the same core, literally, in terms of being in the Marine Corps. And people feel a sense of connection because you're like, you generally know what it's like to be a Marine, even if you had a very different sort of experience than me. But you have more of a shared experience of both being Marines together than two random strangers, right? And so it does bring people together. And that's why I think group therapy in the context of the VA is actually so effective, is because you're like, ah, this is a stranger that's sitting across the room from me, but they know what I've been through. We have similar sort of professional kind of experience. And you're able to become friends much easier with someone who was in the Marines with you, right? Just like if you randomly run across someone who went to the same college as you and you weren't friends at the time, you know, you have inside knowledge, inside jokes, kind of things that you can kind of talk about and relate together. So the conclusion from that I took away is obviously it's not necessarily join the military. If that's obviously aligned with your personal values in terms of serving your country, God bless you and thank you for your service. But what I think we can learn and apply to most men is that doing really challenging, difficult things together. Now, they don't have to be life-threatening. I mean, hopefully not, but I'll tell you my early experiences is, I was really into mountain climbing in my 20s, which is kind of dangerous, especially if you're doing sort of like alpinism, big mountain climbing. Once you start getting up above the tree line, like oxygen levels are low, mountains are really steep, there's real risk involved. And I've done climbing in places where literally people have died. And there's a lot of trust when you go climbing with someone, right? Like you could slip and fall. Is your buddy going to like help you out, rescue you? Or is he going to do something stupid that's going to put your life at risk? So you're literally putting your life on the line and putting your life in the hands of someone else. And when you do that, and hopefully it turns out positively, there's a respect and a connection that you have with that person. Because they're like, you know what? I trusted you literally with my life. And that means something to me, and you mean something to me as a result of that. So I do think there's a bunch of research on this that shows that the amount of time does matter. Obviously, you just need to put in the hours. And I forgot what it is exactly, but it takes like 50 to 100 hours to go from a stranger to a friend. It takes another 50 to 100 hours to go from acquaintance to like a friend to a close friend, and then another whatever to go from a close friend to a best friend. It literally takes hundreds of hours. And so if you literally do the math, think about how much time investment that requires. If you spend, let's say, a couple hours with a buddy on a weekend, you know, and literally you do that every single weekend, minus Christmas, like 50 weeks out of the year, you're hanging out 3 hours a weekend. That's 150 hours, and you're not even in probably best friend territory yet. So it's probably going to take a year, 2 years for you to build, and that's like consistent weekly hanging out, for you to literally invest the time to develop the closeness to go and develop friends, close friends, and best friends. My thesis is that when you do difficult things together, it essentially either accelerates that process or it amplifies that process, so it's even stronger than you would if you just like, I don't know, played volleyball together or you randomly sort of worked together. So that's the thing I would encourage, is find things that are challenging. So sports are a great thing because there's an inherent challenge and competitiveness. Like for instance, if you just find a weightlifting partner and you're both, you know, using the principle of progressive overload, so that over the course of that year, you're pushing each other and you're like, hey, you know what? We want to be bigger. We want to be stronger. I'm only benching, you know, the bar when I start because I've never lifted weights before. And now I want to go from 45 pounds to 145 pounds. That's my goal for the year. And your buddy's going to push you to do that. And once you do that and you sweat and strain and struggle through that process, and you have someone who's pushing you to be better than you can be because he's like, one more rep, let's get it. You're going to have a closer connection with that person. So that's a good example in terms of sports. I actually do think work can actually develop really close relationships. And I think that's why I'm actually really bullish on the return to offices. We literally moved into our new office today. I'm hanging out with Victor, hung out with our designer earlier today. And I do think it, like working on a hard project, right? Like we are trying to bring, you know, effective hormone optimization to the masses and help literally a million men be better in mind and body. That's the mission of Maximus. That is a hard ass mission to go do that, because my first company helped 500,000 people lose 5 million pounds, and we did that in 10 years. So we're trying to help twice as many people in half the time. That's our big, hairy, audacious goal. And it's not easy to do. Like we sit there and we grind, we do this, you know, weekly podcast week after week, and we're gonna slowly see that improve and grow. But the challenge of doing that, I think, helps forge greater bonds and connections with one another. So that's what I would say is try to find hard things to do together, because life is hard. And when you do things that are hard, A, you learn and grow from other people. B, you push yourself beyond your normal capacity and you do much more than you can. I certainly, when I lift or sprint or do something with other people, I go faster and harder than what I would have done it alone. Even though I'm super self-motivated, there's just something about competition that drives males, you know, that I think really works. And obviously, if you're working on something together, maybe not so competitively, like in the workplace context, I don't think you should be competing against your coworkers unless it's like a sales kind of thing. But you're competing against the market. You're competing against other companies. You're competing against not getting crushed into irrelevance. And so you're kind of sitting side by side and you're like, all right, let's go win as a team, right? Or as a company. And I do think that forges stronger bonds. So moral of the story in terms of how do you get greater unity and connection when you're trying to develop these close relationships is you got to invest the time, right? And guys, unfortunately, don't do it. Like, you got to really try to do it on a regular basis. I do encourage, like, spend a few hours a week if you are trying to build something like a close relationship with someone, but you can amplify or accelerate that through the type of activities that you do. If you're just sitting around drinking beers, like, yes, maybe if you're having some really intimate conversation, I think that can help, but you're going to just develop closer relationships if you actually go do hard shit together. So I think that's my advice and encouragement.
We had a comment submitted via Discord. Dr. Cam, I grew up with a hateful and distant mother and had a strong relationship with my father. I am now 52. It took the death of my mother and counseling for me to understand that I never learned to, quote, mother myself. The rise of male helpers, Peterson, Joko, Rogan, that you mentioned being like father or uncle figures, etc., I get and make sense. In short, I seek approval from women. If I need help in an area of life, I prefer working with women, gaining advice from a woman, etc.
And I think the last part of it was like, do you have thoughts about types like me that lacked support on the mother side of things or the books to read, etc.? So first of all, I think it's important and useful that you recognize that pattern, right? That unfortunately, you didn't get sort of what you needed from your mom. Fortunately, it sounds like you did have a strong relationship with your father, and so you got a lot more of the, you know, masculine paternalistic guidance in terms of how to be a man. But I actually do think it's useful in terms of your full development as a man to be basically in touch with your masculine and your feminine. It's very important. In fact, I do think it's important to have good relationships with whether your mother or other sort of close female family members, because it becomes the template if you're a heterosexual male for how you engage in relationships with, you know, your wife or significant other. I do generally find in my clinical practice that guys that have, I hate to use the term mommy issues, but issues with their mom do end up having challenging relationships with their girlfriends, wives, partners, etc. Because particularly if there's remaining or unresolved resentment that happens because you didn't get your needs served from your mother, or you had very commonly an overbearing, anxious mother is typically the pattern that we see, or sometimes a narcissistic mother where you were only rewarded for the things that you did or what you did for your mom rather than just for your being, right? Your wholeness. What ends up happening is there's a residual or lingering resentment towards your mom, and that can often be projected or replicated in the relationships that you have with your romantic partner. And, you know, it's not their fault. They didn't do anything to you, but you almost, you know, they're sort of like the maternal figure that's become the replacement for it. I do think therapy is very helpful. And actually, the first thing I would encourage, and this is contrary to my advice for most men, in this particular situation, I actually think it'd be really helpful to have a female therapist. Right? Because the difference is if you have a resentment towards your mom and then you act out with your girlfriend or wife, she's not going to obviously take it very well and she may leave you. And it's not necessarily, you know, a place where you could get a corrective emotional experience from it, but you know, there's only so much people can tolerate in a relationship. The good thing literally about therapy is that it's a relationship in which the container, the boundaries are designed to hold. Right? So you can kind of get pissed at your therapist or be resentful about the fact that she's not helping you, just like you're resentful how your mom didn't help you when you were a boy growing up. But the difference is in therapy, she can spot that, you can talk about it, you can process it, and she's not going to run away or leave you or punish you like your mom did. And that provides a corrective emotional experience to be like, I can feel resentment towards a woman and work through it in a healthy and constructive way so that I can correct that pattern or habit and I don't enact it or replicate it in my primary relationship with my girlfriend, wife, etc. So I actually think a female therapist would be very helpful. Sometimes, you know, what they call it, the poison is the antidote. And not to say that obviously the therapist is poisonous or women is or poisonous, obviously not. But if it feels toxic in terms of the replication of a unhelpful or problematic relationship with your mother, it's useful. You're going to replicate that. You're actually eliciting the toxicity, right? It's not from the woman. It's the male's projection of resentment or issues that they have. But being able to deal with that in a safe context, obviously not to abuse the therapist, but you know, to be able to work through it in a healthy way, I think would actually be very helpful. So that's actually my primary recommendation. I don't know if there's particular books that I, on this particular note, that I necessarily sort of recommend, but I do think the second part of what you said is really interesting, right? So the caller sort of talked about, in short, I seek approval from women. If I need help in an area of my life, I prefer working with women, getting advice from women, etc. This part of it is a little interesting or unusual to me, right? Because it's actually contrary to what I would expect. Typically, guys who have a strong relationship with their father, but they had a hateful and distant relationship with your mother, usually do the opposite because they're like, well, men are good and safe. At least my father was. And so I generalize that to other men. If I had a hateful and distant mother, I'm generally going to be distrustful of women. Interestingly, in your particular case, it's become the opposite, right? Or maybe you're almost trying to enact that out in terms of seeking approval from women when you never didn't get it from your mom. So I don't know if you're overcorrecting in this particular case, where I like my question is why avoid men in particular, right? Like if you are seeking, you know, advice or help in an area of life, why do you prefer working with women? Like, is that a conscious thing or is it an unconscious thing that I would say? You know, obviously if your dad was helpful, there's going to be other guys who are going to be helpful as well. Don't avoid sort of men and don't overcorrect. Like I said, it may be helpful like with one therapist to try to have like work through your sort of issues that you've had in terms of that. But I think if you're overcorrecting and you're like, oh, okay, I need to only get advice from women, only get approval from women. I just feel more comfortable. Well, maybe not comfortable, but I'm trying to like get what I didn't need for, I didn't get from my mom. And I'm trying to get this from multiple women, which that's my guess for what you're doing. I would actually make the corollary advice and say, don't go crazy in that you need to like just interact with women, because now that you're like overcompensating. So maybe just have one female therapist, but I would encourage you in the rest of your life, maybe actually try to get it more for men, because you don't want to overcompensate, right? If you're avoiding men because one woman didn't get you what you need, why are you sort of either punishing men and excluding them from your life, and you're punishing yourself because you're missing out on great advice, counsel, etc. Also, quite frankly, relationships with men in terms of friendships are less complicated than friendships with women if you're a heterosexual male. So if you are not getting male friendship, male advice, male counsel, you're missing out as a man, and you can obviously get it from women, but it's, like I said, it's harder, it's more complicated, and it's much more challenging. We already talked about how challenging it is for most men to have close relationships, right? If 15% of men don't even have one close friend, if your criteria is they have to be a woman to be your close friend, those odds are going to skyrocket. I would say, I don't think, probably less than the majority of men do not have a close friend that's a woman, I would say. Just because the dynamics are more complicated. Not that you can't, but it's harder. So I don't disqualify yourself from quality male relationships. I think in your particular case, I think you need a diverse and healthy, probably balance of both. I would seek out male friendship counsel in order to not overcorrect, but maybe you need one sort of special relationship with a female therapist that can help you work through the issues that you had with your mom. So I mean, that's generic kind of advice, though. I'd love for you to call back and let us know how that goes.
First question is, hi, I wanted to ask, since I currently have vacations after the first year of college and have more time on my hands, is it recommended to do both cardio and weight training on the same day, 2 to 2.5 hours combined, considering sleep, diet, etc., obviously decently optimized?
So this person is asking, okay, you have some time. Congratulations on finishing your first year of college. So first and foremost, I remember getting through my freshman year and finishing, oh man, 5 or 6 finals, and I was just in over my head. So and especially finishing your first year of college after the pandemic is an extra challenge. So congratulations. I'm glad that you're also spending that extra time that you have not getting silly drunk like most college students, unfortunately, at least used to do. I don't know what people are doing these days. Probably video games and porn, unfortunately. I'm glad that you're investing it into yourself and your health. So the question is it recommended to do both cardio and weight training on the same day, 2 to 2.5 hours? I would say absolutely not. Look, you might get a different opinion from other people, but here's my point of view. You know, someone once told me that you can either work out hard or you can work out long, but you cannot do both. And I think that's a useful rule of thumb to keep in mind. So first of all, unless you are training to compete for a competition, for sports, or you're like a professional, you're a professional or aspiring professional athlete, you do not need to work out for hours a day. That is literally like 1th percentile behavior. It's a different thing if you're trying to get into the Tokyo Olympics. But if you are the average college student, limit your workouts to no more than an hour, I would say. Now, there may be some exceptions to that because of certain types of sports, like if you're playing a tennis match or a soccer game, it may need to go on for more than an hour, but there's a lot of stopping and starting, right? So those things notwithstanding, if you're talking about going to the gym, and that's what it sounds like you're doing, keep it to less than an hour. An hour is a lot, right? If you're jogging at like a, I don't know, brisk pace, like you're a decently trained runner, you know, eight minute a mile pace, you know, you can cover like 7 miles in an hour. And do you really need to run more than that? I would argue no. Same thing. There's nothing that you can't do in a gym in less than an hour. Like you can do full body, literally working out every single muscle group, multiple sets with sufficient rest in less than an hour. So that's rule number one. Keep your workouts to less than an hour. There's no reason that you should be able to do that you should be doing that much. The other thing too is most people aren't doing that multiple days a week, right? So this is comes from, there's an MMA trainer that was on Joe Rogan's podcast, and he was talking about, you know, if you go extra hard on one particular day, whether that's because you did 2, 2.5 hours or your intensity was ridiculous, you're going to end up being very sore the next day. And so his rule of thumb is never be sore, right? Because the reason is you're going to be sore and you're not going to want to do that again. You're not going to repeat that crazy 2, 2.5 hour workout because you're not feeling up to it. And you're certainly not going to do it 5 days in a row, right? So let's say you worked out, you know, whatever, 2, 2.5 hours on Monday, you did it again on Wednesday, and then Friday you ended up skipping it because you were so exhausted at the end of the week that you ended up missing one workout, which it happens, you're human. So how much did you actually work out that week? Literally 4 to 5 hours. Now let's compare that to what I'm saying. Work out for a reasonable amount of time. Let's say an hour every single day, right? So if you worked out an hour every single day, so let's say, you know, till Friday or Saturday, you took Sunday off. I've, using my method, worked out 5 to 6 hours. So literally on a time volumetric basis, my 5 to 6 hours doing 1 hour 5 to 6 days a week has trumped your 2 days of 2, 2.5 hours because you only put in 4 to 5 hours. So in the end, volume wins, and the way that you get volume is more daily consistent types of working out. Now, it doesn't mean to say that you can't do a 3 day a week routine if that just better fits your schedule and that's all you're willing to do, no problem. But you seem like a highly motivated person. The average person is not even talking or thinking about doing a 2, 2.5 hour workout. So for someone like you, I would spread it out, do a daily routine. 5 days a week, I would say, is more than enough. On the 6th day, do some sort of cross training, do something else. That's what I would do, is focus on more consistency. Don't overtrain on any particular day. You shouldn't be particularly sore. and try to get volume in. So you like one way of doing that is count the number of sets that you're doing per muscle group per week. So an example of that is how many times are you hitting your chest every single week, right? So if you're doing 3 sets, 5 days a week, that's 15 sets a week. And we know from the research literature that volumes of 10, 15, 20, even 25 sets a week are really helpful for building both strength and muscle. I don't think you need to do a ton of cardio if you're talking about sort of doing, you know, weight training. My recommendation is do 5 days a week of strength training, do at least 5 days a week of walking, at least 7,500 steps. So focus on the strength training and the walking. Now, on that sixth day, if you want to do a little bit of cardio, whether in the form of high intensity interval training, high intensity, we talked about, I think it was called high intensity repeat training, HIIT, in a previous episode, where there's longer rest intervals. You do like 10 second sprints, 50 seconds of rest, do that 4 to 10 times. It's a little less taxing than HIIT training, especially if you've already worked out 5 days a week. It doesn't tax the central nervous system, the CNS, as much. That could be helpful, or go do something fun. Like, I like playing basketball. If you like playing soccer, it's natural sort of interval training. That should be enough. I don't think you need to go nuts on the cardio. Now, one caveat I will say is if you look at the routines of bodybuilders, some of them do a couple times of cardio, usually sort of a light jog, go run a couple miles. You know, Arnold and his training partners talked about that. But also remember, they're jacked up on so much performance-enhancing drugs, steroids, growth hormones, etc., that they can just do ridiculous amounts of volume that no mere mortal man can do, and allows them to recover and run and do a million other things. So that's a huge mistake. Guys, look at these bodybuilders' routines that are on drugs that literally enhance muscle growth and recovery and think, oh, I should follow the same thing. When it's like, no, you can't do that. Yeah, Arnold can go work out 2, 2.5 hours a day at the gym because he's on drugs that support that. And most people aren't. And I don't encourage you to follow in those footsteps for your health. So given if you're not enhanced, you need to do something that's much more in line with normal physiological recovery. So that's what I would say is, just to summarize, keep it to less than an hour a day, focus on consistency and volume. And then third, focus more on the strength training and just do a lot of walking and do maybe 1 day a week of running, cardio, cross training, that provides you with a little bit of, high intensity, and maybe a little bit of fun too. It just like breaks up the routine a little bit.
What's your opinion on being able to use dopamine to increase your chances of building a healthy habit?
Yeah, so I think this is a little bit of a misunderstanding. So dopamine is involved in habit formation because it's involved in the reinforcement process. So for those not familiar, dopamine is a key neurotransmitter in your brain, and it's very helpful for approach. Like when people have higher dopamine, they're more likely to go seek out things, and it helps with reinforcement, right? So basically, it's involved in the reward process. When you bite into a delicious candy bar, more dopamine is released. And then the second or third or fourth time that you have that candy bar, it's actually released in anticipation of it, even before you bite into it, because you know the reward is coming, right? So it stimulates, like I said, that approach behavior. So that's how it works on a physiological level. I don't know if you quite frankly need to know that or how that actually necessarily helps you in terms of habit formation. Like, you don't need to know how a car's engine works in order to drive a car. That's kind of the analogy that I make. So I don't think the focus is necessarily on dopamine. And even though I have a whole dopamine fasting protocol, I explain how that reinforcement process works. But you don't really need to know like the ins and outs of it in terms of how it necessarily helps you. I do think it's more useful to understand the principles of conditioning, right? Which dopamine may be the molecule or the neurotransmitter that's mediating that process. But what's much more useful is basically understanding like classical and operant conditioning, right? So classical conditioning is when you associate a stimuli and a response, right? So if you just keep doing two things together, you start to associate one thing with the other. Right. So, you know, if you well, I'm just trying to think of like an interesting example, right? So if you're laying in bed and you are anxious, and because you're, I don't know, thinking about all the things that you have to do, and you continue to associate sort of like anxiety and stress with laying in bed, that bed is going to automatically, even though one day you may come home and it's Friday, you have nothing to stress about, you now associate the bed with stress, right? And so you've created a negative, conditioned response, essentially. So yeah, you want to be sort of careful about conditioning. So one tip that may be very useful and applicable in your habit formation is be very careful about contaminating the environment in which you're trying to build positive or healthy habits. Like, I'll give you an example actually from one of our coworkers. He has two separate computers. One is for work, one is for media and entertainment. And it's literally in a different place. I believe it may be in a different room. I actually think it's a brilliant idea. It sounds like overkill, but if you can have two devices, you essentially prevent it from being contaminated. And you don't want to be on your work computer doing social media, having fun, etc., because you're associating that distraction or the stimulation with that. So what I would say is like keep your computer clean, right? Like you know, or if you are going to use social media, do it on your phone, not your work computer, and so you don't contaminate sort of your work computer, contaminate psychologically, what I mean, with the interruption of that habit. You want to ideally and the environment as well. Like if it's your work desk or your work environment, only work in that place. You want to go have fun, go do it in a different room, right? Literally do it in a different place so you don't create a negative sort of conditioning that's going to interfere with your ability to focus and concentrate in that space. So the way that I kind of put it is treat it like a sacred space, right? Your desk only for work, your bed, which is only for sleep and sex. And so same thing, you want to like associate certain spaces or environments with the particular habits that you want to build, and you try not to create contamination, right? So it's the same thing. It's like the way you treat your kitchen. You're not gonna like put things in places that shouldn't be there or contaminate them in terms of like your cutting boards, right? Like the meat cutting board is not the same as the vegetable cutting board because of cross-contamination. It's the same thing with your spaces. So that's a very helpful tip that I think may be helpful. You don't need to like understand how dopamine works to understand that. I think you just need to understand that there is conditioning that happens, and the way that you want to avoid negative conditioning is to treat your spaces as sacred, and isolate particular times and places and spaces with the habit and the behavior that you want to reinforce in order to keep it as sort of clean and pure and uncontaminated as possible.
We had a comment on YouTube. Is Cam currently following the Keystone habit?
I actually am doing my best. So as part of actually our alpha group, we are actually pushing each other to do little Keystone habits and accountability check-ins. So I try to do it at least once a day. Sometimes, of course, I'm human and slip up, but as part of the fifth health behavior, so the five health behaviors are diet, exercise, sleep, focus, being part of the Keystone habit, but also accountability. So we keep ourselves accountable by posting. We kind of publicly post our Keystone habit in terms of our alpha group. So I find that I'm more able to do it when I do it with social support and accountability, and having the reinforcement of the group makes me do it more often. So yes, and I can always do it better. There's a question from Carlos in terms of when the negative conditioning has been created, is it possible to reverse it? Deassociate some stimuli with shitty habits. Yes, it is. In fact, that's like the basis of how you treat insomnia, right? Just as like I said, you could create negative conditioning with the bed. If you're associating with rumination, anxiety in bed, you can be conditioned. So like for an example of this is sleep hygiene. If people are using their phones or laptops or TV in bed and it's keeping them up and overstimulated, the first thing we do is we say, no devices in bed, right? Go put it in a different room or go watch it in a different room. So it helps decondition you, or what we call it extinguishes that conditioned response. And so, yes, anything that you can learn, you can unlearn. It just takes time, right? And so the more that you, disassociate those things, you can unlearn essentially bad habits. The thing that's really interesting though, is that in the connection in the brain, it may not go away completely. The temptation, it's very easy to re-stimulate the bad habit. But essentially what you're doing is you're weakening the neuronal association with it. So the temptation for addiction may always be there. And I think that's why addiction is still the hardest problem in the world to solve, but you can do a lot to, counter condition, decondition, or extinguish bad habits. So yes, that does work. Thank you so much for a great call and radio show, our 30th actually show. So thank you for everyone who called in and asked us great questions on Discord. Appreciate those who are listening on Twitter Spaces. Thanks, Carlos and folks who are listening on Instagram Live, and the folks who joined us on YouTube, writing in our questions as well. Thank you, everyone. Have a wonderful rest of your day.